Hey everybody, it's Kai. All of us at Make Me Smarter taking a little holiday break for the next couple of weeks, but we couldn't leave you high and dry, so we are revisiting some of our best episodes from 2021. And if you've enjoyed listening to our show this past year, do us a favor, would you consider making a year-end gift to Marketplace and Make Me Smart? Your financial support is a critical part of our budget, and we've got thank you gifts at every donation level. You can give at marketplace.org/givesmart or click the link in the show notes. And thanks.
Beautiful. Hey, everyone. It's Molly Wood. Welcome back to Make Me Smart, the show where, especially on Tuesdays, none of us is as smart as all of us.
Especially on Tuesdays. This is the day, as regular listeners will know, when we take, and if you're not a regular listener, first of all, why not? Deep dive into a single topic. And today we're going to do a little history. We're going to do a little economics. We're going to do a little social policy, I think. Probably we're going to get there. We're going to talk about Reaganomics and trickle-down economics and supply-side economics, what it all meant, and more importantly, what it all means right now in the era of the Biden presidency.
Yes. As I mentioned yesterday on the show, we find ourselves in this remarkable position where folks of a certain age have essentially lived a little chunk of history. And we seem to be at a pivot point. So we're going to go back first for the historical perspective. This idea of trickle-down economics, supply side, small government that would lead to more investment and then everybody would win was championed, of course, by President Ronald Reagan, who said the following in his 1981 inaugural address.
In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
So here we have another crisis, right? We're coming out of a pandemic. We've got a president whose name is Joe Biden, who wants to spend $3 trillion on infrastructure and human capital. He's going to be raising taxes, if he has his way, on corporations and the wealthiest part of the income spectrum in this economy. So the question is the era of big government being over, right? That's what I want to ask. That's
right.
The thing.
Exactly. So we have someone to make us smart because it's Tuesday and we need some help. Mark Blythe is a political economist at Brown University's Watson Institute for International and Public Affairs. Welcome.
That's great to be with you.
So let's go with the most obvious first question. Sorry. Good. You
want
to go, Molly,
exactly.
Or you want me to go? All right.
Well, I suspect it's the same question, right?
I think we need to define terms, right? Because these terms get batted around a lot. So Reaganomics, trickle-down, supply-side economics. In a nutshell, what are we talking about?
In a nutshell, you're talking about the 1981 Economic Recovery Act. If there's a singular statement of Reaganomics, that's it. So it had a whole bunch of stuff that was meant to fit together and kind of did, but in a really peculiar way. So the first one was tax cuts for business. There'd been a big campaign in the 70s because of the effect of inflation, saying that investment was lagging, that America needed more capital formation, so big tax cuts for business. Then there was the whole influence of Art Laffer and the Laffer Curve, mm-hmm. and that was equivalent for individual income, so cut the top end of the tax distribution so that it will trickle down to everybody else. But there was a whole bunch of other stuff that was going on in there as well we forget about. Compensating for this, but also blowing out the deficit in Reagan's period, was a huge defense buildup. Right? This is the second Cold War. This is the second showdown with the Soviet Union. There was also a lot of action on deregulating business while re-regulating labor, and particularly the PATCO strike of 1981 with the air traffic controllers.
Yeah.
Right? So there's a lot of stuff going on there. And then finally, what was going on was Volcker running the Federal Reserve, because he jacked up interest rates to, in nominal terms, 20% in order to crush inflation. And that caused a big recession at the same time that Reagan's doing all this stuff, which blows out the debts and the deficit. So you wouldn't think that this would go down well, right? You'd think this would be a footnote in history, but it ended up having real staying power.
Why was that, do you think? I mean, it sounds like we are right to identify this as a pivot point for a lot of things that have happened since. Why did it work?
It worked because he got lucky. I mean, that's the thing about the Gipper or whatever he was known as. I'm just about old enough to remember. But he really got lucky, and he got lucky in two ways. The first one was that the disinflation of the economy, getting rid of all that inflation, it was really brutal, but it was actually done very, very quickly. So inflation dropped, and at the same time, they deregulated financial markets. Suddenly, there was a tsunami of credit that was available in the economy that really hadn't been available before. And then the third third way they got lucky was America's running big budget deficits and also big trade deficits. But they get lucky because when they deregulate finance, interest rates still stay quite high in America vis-a-vis the rest of the world. So Japanese corporates, remember all the big Japanese corporations that were buying Pebble Beach Golf Course and all this nonsense, right? They're getting 2% holding their money at home. They're getting 5% just dumping it in the United States. They're the ones that start to buy the bonds that finance the debt and the deficit. So that's how Reaganomics gets lucky in the kind of middle part of the 1980s. Morning in America was definitely helped.
Well, right. No, exactly. And so Reagan goes to the polls in 84, morning in America. How does what's happening at that really macro level trickle down, pun intentional, to the average person? Mm-hmm. Why even today do you hear people saying, oh, yeah, Reaganomics was great, man. I loved it. And you're like, well,
it really? It's a peculiar thing because, I mean, we know that it didn't work. I mean, there's been study after study now. There's one that you can go just type in the following, trends in income 1979 to 2020, done by the Rand Corporation, not exactly a left-wing think tank, right?
Yeah.
And these guys estimate that $43 trillion trickled up from the bottom 90th to the top 10%, and pretty much none of it came back down. So when you've got that big disconnect, what explains such a disconnect? I think part of what made Reaganomics work and what made the whole kind of neoliberal revolution, if you want to call it, work, is that it accords with everyday's common sense. So a good example of this is the whole sort of notion that, like, well, when you run the government, it's like running like a household budget. And if you spend too much, you need to cut spending. Well, you know, that rather ignores the fact that I don't get to issue my own currency. There's no such thing as a Kai Risdell bond market.
Not yet.
Right? Nobody in the Wood family is importing immigrants and taxing them for five generations. But because all that stuff accords with common sense, it's an easy sell. And it's particularly credible when the party of business is the one who's selling it. So I think it's the way that it's not about the facts in the world. It's about the kind of models we have in our head and the way the economy works that made it really work for Reaganomics.
So is it fair to say, as you were talking, I wrote this list, right? So it sounds like you are describing an economic recovery act. Hold on, I have a quick question, because I wasn't that old then. What was the economy recovering from?
Oh, really?
Ah, great question. It was recovering from the 1970s.
Yeah,
and right, the 1970s had two things going on. One was a huge amount of labor militancy across the world, strikes everywhere, right? And this is the point at which labor's share of national income hit its all-time high. Conversely, the way that business was dealing with this was pushing on in prices. How do you keep paying for higher wages? You push on in prices. And that was generating the inflation that we saw in the period. Now, if you're a businessman and you expect to get 5% real rate of return and inflation goes to 10%, you might as well take the money around the back of the house and burn it. And that's what basically brought a huge mobilization of business groups together in the late 70s to push these ideas. The idea of capital formation crisis, the idea that we need tax cuts to stimulate the economy. This didn't just spring out of nowhere. It came out of a concerted business campaign in reaction to both labor militancy and inflation's effects on profits.
All right. Huh. So,
okay. Well, yeah, that seems super relevant to the moment. But can I do a twofer?
Right. Yeah.
Because it seems like, okay, so as a result of this Recovery Act, it seems like we have set the stage for the declining power of labor, which we've seen since in stagnant wages, for the increase in household debt, right? Rising income inequality, fewer rules and more profits for banks, a smaller social safety net, and the rise of the military-industrial complex.
I think you just explained the whole thing. That's exactly where it came from. If you're going to set up a tax structure that siphons 90% of it up to the top and doesn't really trickle it down, the only way you're going to have any semblance of maintaining consumption for most people is a massive expansion of credit. And the greatest trick that's ever been played by finance is to tell everybody what they call an asset is actually a liability. Right. So when you borrow from finance, right, you think that that's an asset for them. No, that's a liability. Right. So they want the income stream from your payment. That's their asset. So when banks get big, what it means is they're lending an enormous amount of money to the economy. And we saw what happened with that when it finally became unstuck in 2008. So that's just one part of the story. But yep, that's exactly right. It all comes out of this period.
All right, so let's keep going chronologically here and talk about how the mindset shifted, right? So Reagan, 1980, 81, 84 goes Morning in America. Clinton gets elected in 92. And then in 96, Clinton says the era of big government is over. Reagan has, almost from the grave at that point, I mean, he was still around, but he has co-opted maybe the most liberal president since, like, FDR.
Absolutely. And exactly the same thing happens in Britain 5 years later when Mrs. Thatcher declares that Tony Blair is her best pupil. Right? So what is it about these centre-left parties that they got trapped in this kind of right-wing economic box? Well, part of it was because there were real benefits. If you think about Walmart's slogan from a few years ago, the prices keep falling. Why? Because it's all made in China. So if you think about your real wage is what you can effectively buy, if the prices of stuff is falling, in a sense, your wages are going up even though no one's giving you a pay rise. So there were certain benefits from integration, globalization, etc., that kind of masked the inequality that was there. But Clinton himself got stuck because when he came in, you'll remember he wanted to do two things. First one was a stimulus, just like Biden, much smaller. The second one was a BTU tax, an actual thermal tax on basically energy use, the first green tax. And what happened was Alan Greenspan essentially sat him down and said, don't even think about it. Because if you do, I'll jack up interest rates, you'll have a recession and you're done. And that's explicitly what was said to Clinton 92, 93. And he backed away from that. Very quickly had no other ideas, was regarded as a lame duck president, and then mounted a campaign in 96, which got him back into power. But in a sense, he had no agenda. And his instinct was to cooperate. So what did he cooperate on? Welfare reform. So you end up with the irony that this two-term Democratic president is the one who not only the era of big government is over, in the same speech as we are ending welfare as we know it.
Which is where we should probably acknowledge the baked in racism in these policies, right? And all of the rhetoric and even welfare reform ultimately targeted people of color, and in Reagan's case, pretty explicitly.
Well, there was the famous metaphor that Reagan bandied around of the welfare queen, who was living off of benefits by having excess children and driving around in a Cadillac. And there was no doubt that the cosmetic on that one was not a white person, right? That was absolutely true. And you see this with criminal justice in the period all the way through to the Willie Horton saga, the whole thing. So yeah, I mean, there's always been a racial undercurrent to these reforms. And why do you push on that one? Because it's an easy target. You push on that one because essentially that community is captured by the Democrats. And if you push on that one, you'll get support for it in many quarters. But it's very hard for that community to push back.
Okay. So let's skip over a decade or two, right? So we get through Obama and he's dealing with a crisis and does some stuff on healthcare. And here we are now with Joe Biden with $1.9 trillion in a COVID relief package, some of which is not related actually to pandemic relief, but also now a $3 trillion infrastructure program, which is going to be partly roads and bridges and green and digital, but also partly human capital. Are we going too far if we say the era of big government is over?
I don't think you are. I think it depends on the legacies, which bit of Reaganomics sticks around. And the way that you see that now is the kind of the shadow boxing behind the Biden stimulus and Biden proposals between people like Larry Summers on the one side and younger Democrats on the other. This fight over whether this will cause inflation, right? The model that's there is essentially one that's from the 1980s and 1990s, that when government spends money, there's only so much employment and so much wages can be generated before it becomes an inflationary problem. And what we've seen over the past 20 years is that we can have seemingly any level of unemployment we want in the economy with a very low rate of inflation. Right. And that seems to be true everywhere. So there's been a bit of learning here in the policy community that, hang on, maybe that just isn't as true as it used to be. And in a sense, the fight over that is also a generational fight. The younger economists are the one who are willing to say, no, the Fed should run the economy hot. This is Claudia Sam's line has been consistently so, right? And we can afford to do this. And more importantly, what they're also saying is, if you don't do this, we've had stagnant wages, in real terms, the same level since the 1970s, for the bottom 60% of the United States. Half the country earns $20 an hour or less. How do you do the American dream on $20 an hour? We need to get wages up. And if you see that as kind of the fulcrum, right, that's where this gets sorted out. If they keep pushing and it doesn't cause inflation, then it's done. then we've definitely turned the corner. If it does produce inflation, then it stops dead in its tracks.
Yeah, sorry, let me just climb in here and get really wonky for a second, right? On this whole inflation and unemployment and all of that. First of all, the Phillips curve, Jay Powell himself has said the Phillips curve is dead, right? That relationship between unemployment going down and inflation going up. That is no more. And yet we are still living with the specter of Paul Volcker and 1970s inflation. I asked Neel Kashkari, who's now the president of the Minneapolis Fed, I asked him, what the hell are you guys so scared of? And he basically said Paul Volcker in the 1970s. Still, 30, 40 years later.
Mm-hmm. And much of this is a generational change. I mean, it's really instructive if you go back to the 1930s and 1940s and you think about what made the New Deal possible, what made this change towards Keynesian economics, a bigger role for the state in the economy. A lot of it was generational. I mean, essentially, you know, 70-year-old economists had run the shop for a long time.
Yeah.
Their ideas didn't seem to work anymore. And then their students came along and said, no, we need to do more or less the opposite. And that's really kind of, if you will, the mechanism of the pendulum swinging. And I think that you see a lot of that these days as well. There's a big generational shift behind this as well as a shift in ideas.
Huh. Well, one thing we should probably point out, too, is that there's a generational shift. There is ideas, there's philosophy, but there are also winners. I mean, income inequality, we tend to talk about those who have been on the lower end, right, who have not received, who have not been trickled down to. But there are a lot of winners in this economy who probably don't want to give up that status, right? And is it fair to say that over all of these years, those people have also become, for example, big political donors?
Oh, I think that's undoubtedly the case. In fact, there's a brilliant study by a political scientist called Marty Gillens back from 2015. And what he did was he basically looked at the relationship between the preferences of different parts of the income distribution for policies. So what does the top 20% want? What does the bottom 20% want? And then look at what Congress actually legislates for, top 20% all the way. Even in the 1960s, right? So essentially, they're the people that contribute. They're the people who turn out. They're the ones that go to fundraisers locally and nationally. Yeah, they're the ones that matter in that sense. But there's also a feeling amongst that group that, you know what, maybe the party's over. Maybe we've taken all we can. Maybe we're kind of fragilizing the whole economy. Maybe having millions of people on gig work isn't actually the future for our country that we want. So I think there's a moment of reflection even within that class about where we've been traveling and if it's ultimately sustainable. And particularly when you bring into the conversation the climate crisis, that begins to really change it because there is literally no way of addressing that without bigger state action.
So in 40 years, do you think we're talking Bidenomics or are we still talking about Reaganomics?
We might be talking Bidenomics. I really think a lot of this comes down to this, like, let's run this giant $2 trillion experiment on if we can generate inflation or not. And if we get real wage growth without any significant inflation, I think that Bidenomics will actually become a thing just as Reaganomics did. And if we think about, you know, when I described Reaganomics at the start, it was this whole contradictory bunch of measures that shouldn't really work and shouldn't fit together, but they went ahead and did it anyway. And with a little bit of luck and a turning of the business cycle and the expansion of finance and the Japanese buying your debt, they got away with it. Maybe Biden's basically riding that same train.
Mark Blythe, he's a political economist at the Watson Institute for International and Public Affairs at Brown. Mark, thanks a lot. I really appreciate your time.
Thanks
great
so much.
To talk to you.
Man,
bye-bye.
Good stuff.
Tremendous.
Good stuff. That was great. We could have gone another 15 minutes.
I mean, definitely could have.
Yeah.
Yep. I don't know all the curves and everything, but yeah. I had many more questions because actually, like, it seems to me that the follow-on episode to this in some ways is globalization, which we sort of touched on briefly. But that's the thing that enables the prices to be low enough that people get away with not making any more. And in fact, we're maybe to the point where the price of things is lower than what it costs to actually produce them. Like, it's a whole house of cards.
Yeah.
That has to keep up with our, you know, stagnant wages. I mean.
Yeah. No, it was good.
It is
awesome.
Great.
That was great.
This is great. All right. So now we see. Now we enter the new era and also a break. Send us your comments on today's show. I'm really proud of that one. You can do that by sending us an email or ideally a voice memo. makemesmart@marketplace.org. You just digest for a minute, everyone. Think it through. We'll be right back.
Thank you. Get one of the most successful broadcasts in television history on your schedule with the 60 Minutes podcast. Hard-hitting investigative reports, news, and culture maker interviews, and in-depth profiles are waiting for you in every episode. Listen to 60 Minutes every Sunday wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, we're back. Time for some news. Okay, I got two, or actually what I've got is like, I've got two halfsies is what I've got, which equals one. So I'm going to stay under my limit. You're not buying that? Okay. Number one is a follow on to my item yesterday of how we're not really ever going back to office work as we know it. And lo and behold, in the Wall Street Journal today, a story about J.P. Morgan and Salesforce. Here, I'll just read the headline and we're done.
Yeah.
J.P. Morgan and Salesforce join growing list of firms dumping office space. And those two were ginormous companies who were saying, you know what? We don't need all those bajillions of square feet of office space. And it's a problem I know in San Francisco, and it's going to be a problem in New York. And I would just like to make sure everybody realizes that, because it ain't going to be normal. It ain't going to be normal. And I'll tell you what, Marketplace will be dumping several, you know, 100 square feet of office space, I would say. And just following on my earlier wonkiness about the Phillips curve and all this, I just want to point out the yield on the 10-year Treasury note up to 1.74 again today, which two things. Number one, it used to be 0.5%. The government used to be able to borrow money back in March of last year at 0.5% for 10 years. That rate has now tripled in the last 12 months. Still incredibly low, but it is a movement of which we should take note for two reasons. Number one, that whole inflation thing that Mark was talking about, you're going to hear all kinds of people now saying, oh my God, inflation. And Jay Powell is going to put his fingers in his ear and go, no, 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 because I don't want to talk about the bond market because I got it under control. That's number one. Number two is the thing that also goes along with rising bond yields are expectations for economic growth, which is a good thing. We need economic growth for a whole lot of reasons, not the least of which is we're coming out of a pandemic and businesses just need the activity. But yield is up on the 10-year. Pay attention. That's all.
Because if the yield is up on the 10-year, it means that people are more optimistic about the shorter term, like they're buying shorter term bonds or they're investing
in
the stock market instead of in
10-year. It's maturity non-denominational, right? Because the 10-year is the benchmark on a whole bunch of things. I don't know what the 30-year is doing today, and I don't know what the 1 month is doing today, but the 10-year is the benchmark, and that's the one that the bond market itself keeps an eye on.
Okay.
All right.
I'm going to put my fingers in my ears about inflation too. Stop trying to make fetch happen.
There you go. That's right.
I have two pieces that I just think are pretty relevant because we have talked occasionally about cryptocurrency and whether it's real and how nobody actually uses it to buy anything. They just use it to try to make like a whole bunch of money and junk. And as it turns out, just basically on the same day today, Reuters reporting that PayPal will start letting people in the United States use their cryptocurrency holdings to pay at online merchants, which is very significant if you can actually, you know, digitally do that. And Visa said it will allow the use of the crypto, a specific cryptocurrency called USD Coin, to settle transactions on its payment network, which means that these things are slowly migrating into use as currencies, which has always been in the name, but so far they've mostly just been an asset class.
Do you think
get on board, man?
I'm conflicted about this in many, many ways. Not the least of which is there are 42,000 cryptocurrencies out there. Don't we have to pick one?
I mean, we don't, but they do. So it is notable that Visa was like USD Coin. And right. I don't know I don't know that much about USD Coin, but maybe it's a stable coin as in backed by US currency. For example, I suspect that as these companies start to choose and payment networks start to choose, especially if they like lean into things like stablecoin or say, you know, we think these ones are less volatile and we're in on that, that will probably drive the direction of some of these currencies and, of course, consolidation. Yes, that's going to have to happen. Yeah. They're not going to be able to support all of them, and I don't think they intend to. But as they choose winners, that will create winners,
okay,
which will be interesting too.
All right.
I mean, at this point, with all digital transactions, it actually makes perfect sense. Like, you don't now you don't have to have a, like a Bitcoin ATM and turn it into real money and do this math all the time. Like, if you were just like, Visa, send some chunk of my USD coin. Great. It's starting to work.
There's a show to do about this stuff. That's a very unformed thought. Anyway, whatever. Okay.
We could just call it, it's getting real.
It's getting real. Yeah.
Maybe. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway.
Anyway, that's it for the news fix. And now your turn to talk. Let's do the mailbag.
Hello, Molly and Kai.
It's Brianna from Phoenix.
Ivan from Brooklyn, New York.
Longtime listener, first time voicemailer.
I want to discuss a slightly different, but maybe related thing.
Boom.
Our first episode, our first voice memo. I don't know, man. I'm just limping toward the spring break. Our first voice memo is in response to last week's episode on the tax gap.
Hey, Kai and Molly. This is Margaret from Long Beach, California. I just got finished listening to the episode where you two are just gobsmacked that our legislators have not managed to close all of these tax loopholes that could get slash save us so much money. And I was nodding along with you.
Until.
But then I got to wondering, could our esteemed Congress people have a personal incentive not to close those tax loopholes because they're using them? Or could our esteemed Congress people have an incentive to not close those tax loopholes because they're getting donations from all of these rich people who are definitely using them? Now I've depressed myself. Anyway, thanks for making us smarter.
Or hear me out now.
I'll do you one better. I'm going to go with both.
Yeah, both of those can be true.
Both of those are certainly true.
You betcha.
Yes.
Not a doubt, but we do appreciate the voice memo. That was right up there.
Genius. Well done.
Judy in Massachusetts sent us this one. We were talking the other day about Alan Turing being honored on the UK's new 50-pound note. Here you go.
I'd like to also point out to you that another unsung hero, or heroine, I should say, of World War II and breaking codes was Elizabeth Smith Friedman. She broke the Enigma cipher at about the same time as Alan Turing. However, she used substantially different methodologies, but got sent to the same end result. A book has been written, and there has been a PBS series on her recently, and I think that she also needs to get her due, along with all the other men who broke codes during World War II.
Amen. Yes, absolutely. Elizabeth Smith Friedman, for sure. Didn't know about her, but now I do, and I'll look her up. You betcha.
We have been made smarter. This is why I love this show.
Totally.
And thank you, because I hate it when that happens. And you're absolutely right.
Yep.
And by that, I mean the historical trend of women not getting credit for the stuff.
For sure.
Okay. We have one more voice memo. Man, we got some good stuff today.
We do.
One more voice memo on our favorite topic, the big boat.
Hi, Kai and Molly. This is Aaron here with my son, Nolan, calling from Massachusetts. In all the photos and coverage we've seen of the Ever Given, the heavy equipment used in the attempt to dislodge it has been described as a bulldozer. Obviously, it's a wheel loader, also known as a front-end loader or a bucket loader. My almost three-year-old is incensed at the universal inaccuracy of the description of this piece of equipment. I told him that Kai and Molly really value accuracy on their show, so you all would be a great place to start to try to correct this misinformation. He looks almost satisfied now. But he's not ready to comment on it.
Oh, I'd have paid money to hear that kid. Yes, yes.
Me too.
Absolutely. Nomenclature matters. And I had many years ago, I had a three-year-old who was exactly the same way with the heavy equipment thing. So thank you for that one, Aaron and Noah. I appreciate it.
Oh, I appreciate it.
Awesome.
Wheel loader.
Yes.
I believe I saw it described as Twitter. I'm trying to look up the photo real fast because I believed I saw it described on Twitter as a tracked loader, which sounds different from a wheel loader. So I don't want to contribute to the confusion. I will only say we are going to get to the bottom of this and make sure it is correct.
Yes. That is our promise to you, our listeners.
All right, and now we leave you with the answer to the Make Me Smart question, which is, what is something you thought you knew and you later found out you were wrong about? Today's answer comes from a great interview I did recently on Marketplace Tech, Ania Williams, a principal at the investment firm Omidyar Network.
One thing that I thought I knew, I thought that perfectionism, like that being perfect, like being perfect or getting things perfect would be kind of like a superpower that would help me get places and do things and be seen in a certain way. And I realized that that is not true. All that does is just make my life so much harder. Done is better than perfect, people.
Yes. Yes.
Right?
That.
Done
especially
is better than
now.
Perfect.
Especially now.
So
you know?
I know.
For sure.
I felt almost attacked by that. I was like, what do you mean? This is the only thing I know how to do. Is just right. Be more perfect. Yeah. I spoke to, you can hear, by the way, she, I mean, just is fantastic. We had such a good conversation and I love her. I spoke with her last month on Marketplace Tech about how Black users actually have driven the success of Clubhouse, which is now being copied in a bajillion different ways across the internet.
Yep. Social audio apparently is the next big thing.
I mean, isn't that what we do?
Yeah.
Okay, not really, because other people don't get to talk. But wait, some people just talked. Anyway, don't forget to send us your answer to the Make Me Smart question in a voice memo, like we can all talk, like social audio or whatever. That question, of course, is, what is something you thought you knew that you later found out you were wrong about? You can reach us one more time at makemesmart@marketplace.org.
And there is still time, by the way, to get your questions and comments in for What Do You Want to Know Wednesday, which is tomorrow. That's it for us today. We'll be back.
Bye. I got to find the pictures of that thing again just to make sure we get it right.
Well, the problem is there were a couple of things, right? There was the backhoe thing, and then there was a pusher thing. Mm-hmm. So there's a couple of things we have to figure out.
I know. We'll get to the bottom of it. Okay. Make Me Smart is pretty. We'll do it for the children. Make Me Smart is produced and directed by Marissa Cabrera, who I think we can all agree found the perfect guest for today. Tony Wagner is our digital producer. Erica Phillips writes our newsletter. And our smart and our skill on Alexa. I can't do it.
Garrett Lang engineered this stellar Peabody winning podcast role. Liana Scolacci is going to mix it later on. Ben Talladay and Daniel Ramirez did our theme music. The senior producer is Donna Tam, shaking her head right now in deep, deep despair. The executive director of On Demand is Tar Nieves. Got out with the music. Doesn't happen much.
Woo!
Boom.
Done is better than perfect, Donna.
Yep. That's right.
New life motto.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.